Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the Republican promise to replace her has profound implications for American politics and policy. What are the potential legal impacts? How will it shape public policy, the checks and balances of the Constitution, and the 2020 election? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On September 18th, Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away from pancreatic cancer. A longtime liberal voice on the court, her death has opened the likelihood of a court shifting to the right, perhaps quite dramatically. This is because President Trump is expected to name a very conservative judge to the court. It has also opened a bitter partisan divide in the midst of an already emotional election year. On today's show, we will examine the court's role in American politics, the likely legal outcomes of this battle, and the impact on the 2020 election. In our first segment, we examine the impact on the court's decisions themselves. Our guests are Sanford Levinson, the W. St. John Garwood and W. St. John Garwood Jr. Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas. He's the author of numerous books, including Democracy and Dysfunction with Jack Balkin and Fault Lines in the Constitution with Cynthia Levinson, the latter coming out in graphic novel form, I believe, this month.
Yeah, it came out a couple of days ago.
Perfect. And Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean and Jesse H. Chopper, Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. He is author of numerous books as well, including We the People, a progressive reading of the Constitution for the 21st century. Sanford Levinson, we'll start with you first. Where do you see the biggest legal impact with an addition of a new conservative judge on this court?
Legal has two questions, and I really, two meanings in this context, and I really defer to Erwin with regard to decisions of the Supreme Court, because he's a master of this in a way that I'm not. But I think there are two ways in which this could have profound constitutional impact. First of all, I'm certain that Erwin and I agree on the importance of getting rid of life tenure. And I think we agree on substituting single, non-renewable 18-year terms. Secondly, I think it is quite likely that if the court is packed with the third Trump appointee, it will be very, very difficult for Democrats, if Democrats have control of Congress, otherwise it doesn't matter, but if Democrats have control of Congress, it will be very difficult for Democrats not to wish to expand the court, I would suggest, to 13, that is four new appointments, rather than be good sports. I think that a lot of the political universe right now is divided between people who think that Democrats really have to be good sports, whatever happens, and other people who think that Democrats should start playing constitutional hardball of a very hard variety.
Now, Erwin Chemerinsky, I know that issue of expanding the size of the court was the theme of an opinion piece that you had written in the LA Times. Could you talk a bit about that piece and what you are advising the Democrats? How should they respond to an additional conservative judge?
Let me start by saying what a pleasure it is to do this and pleasure to stand here. And I agree with everything that he just said. In answer to your specific question, I think what the Democrats need to be clear about is that the Republicans have packed the court over what's gone on over the last 4 years. What happened in 2016 was unprecedented. Never before had a political party said they wouldn't hold hearings of a vote on a presidential nominee. And Mitch McConnell said, we should, in an election year, let the people decide by who they choose as president of the United States. You can find quotes from so many prominent Republicans, Mike Lee and Lindsey Graham, saying, we shouldn't allow a lame duck president to fill a seat on the court. And of course, as soon as Justice Ginsburg died, immediately Mitch McConnell was there saying, we have to fill the seat now and we have to bring it up for a vote. I agree with Sandy that I think the right number is 13. Otherwise, there would be a six 5 conservative majority if it's just 11, as opposed to a 6-3 conservative majority if it's 9. I think it's with 13 seats that there can be a Democratic majority. And as presented as, this is the Democrats increasing the size to offset the Republicans packing the court. I know that the concern is going to be, where's the stopping point? If the Democrats increase to 11 or 13, then when the Republicans have the White House in Congress, say in 2028, maybe they'll then make it 15 or 17. And that's the risk. But the alternative for Democrats is unilateral disarmament. The alternative is a court that is going to be deeply conservative, far more conservative than the American people, for a decade or more to come.
You know, with that in mind, one of the greatest concerns about this court and in the immediacy is the potential impact this court could have on the election itself. The president has said on numerous occasions that one of the reasons why he needs to fill this seat is because the federal courts, or perhaps the Supreme Court, is going to decide this election. How problematic is that, Sandy?
Well, if we had been having this interview 20 years ago, I would have expressed some cautious optimism that I knew something about the Supreme Court and how it might behave in a situation like Bush versus Gore. But I think that political scientists and lawyers both were quite shocked by what the court did. And frankly, all bets are off. I would presume that John Roberts desperately hopes that the court does not get involved in having to decide the election. Because back at the time of Bush versus Gore, I think it was Justice Stevens who said that the court will never recover from the blemish on the notion of the impersonal rule of law. You know, I think to some extent that's true, but the court has kind of ridden that out. If the court were to throw the election to Donald Trump, I think it would be worse than Dred Scott, quite frankly, in terms of the effects on the legitimacy of the Supreme Court as an institution. And I literally cannot imagine that John Roberts wants that to happen.
There is a very disturbing pattern right now going on in the courts with a strong partisan divide. 2 weeks ago, from where we're speaking now, the Fifth Circuit overturned a district court order. The district court said everyone in Texas should have an absentee ballot. And the Fifth Circuit, with a Republican appointee writing, said, no, we're not going to expand the availability of absentee ballots. And a Democratic appointee dissenting. The next day, the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit said that Florida could require that ex-felons have to pay all their fines and fees in order to vote, which would keep 775,000 people from voting. The Supreme Court has said the right to vote is fundamental. It can't be conditioned on ability to pay. All of the Republican nominees to the 11th Circuit were in the majority. All the Democratic nominees were in dissent. Now let's talk about the Supreme Court. There have been 3 instances in which federal district courts have tried to expand the availability of absentee ballots to protect the right to vote in Wisconsin, Alabama, and in Texas. And in all 3, the Supreme Court, 5-4, didn't allow the district court orders to go into effect. The 5 Republican-appointed justices and the majority, the 4 Democratic-appointed justices dissenting. I don't mean to put this in such partisan terms, but right now what the Republicans led by Donald Trump most want is to decrease the vote. And so far, the judges seem to be following that party ideology, not the Constitution.
I agree with, or I mean, obviously the facts are exactly as he set out. You know, I think part of it, frankly, I'm not a big fan of John Roberts. I think that he is quite happy to join in voter suppression if it's relatively low visibility, so that only insiders like Irwin are aware of the cases he just mentioned. I do believe that if the eyes of the world were on him, where it really is a case, as in 2000, of choosing the president, that we just don't know what Roberts would do. And there is, of course, the added paradox or irony that Trump hates Roberts. Now, this is why it's important to get the Trumpista judge, because maybe the result would be 5-4 with Roberts joining the three remaining Democrats, should there really be the equivalent of a pooch. And that's why it is so important, I think, for the Republicans not to wait to capture control of the court. Now, quite frankly, I don't know what Amy Barrett's views are on voting and voter suppression. We do know that if she's appointed, Roe is dead. You know, maybe Irwin knows, I'm sure that Irwin knows more about Amy Barrett or the judge from Miami than I do.
Well, I agree with Sandy. I think that if either of these women get confirmed, and obviously it looks like one of them will be, Roe is going to be overruled. I felt going into this past year that there were four justices who were going to vote to overrule Roe: Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. And the question was whether Roberts would join them in overruling Roe or just allow states to chip away at Roe. In June, he voted with the liberals to strike down a Louisiana law imposing restrictions on abortion. I think the reason for that is that the Fifth Circuit had so disobeyed the Supreme Court. Roberts was making a decision for institutional reasons, saying, you have to follow Supreme Court decisions. But I think with either Amy Coney Barrett and everything we know about her, or Barbara Lagoa and everything we know about her, there's five votes to overrule Roe. This has been central to conservative judicial ideology for decades. They now have the votes, and I don't think they're going to wait very long because they know unpredictable things happen, and they want to do it and do it while they know they've got the votes.
Although one of the great concerns there, of course, is that Roe was not a 5-4 decision. Being a 7-2 decision, the idea of overturning a case that's been law, you know, for decades, even with such a narrow decision, is there any sense of caution or alarm that the decision would be overturned 5-4, or am I being a bit too idealistic about principles of law as opposed to counting votes? Sandy, I'll ask you first.
I think you're being too idealistic.
I think these five justices want to overrule Roe. They would love it if Roberts would come with them and make it 6-3, but that's not what their focus is going to be. Theirs is going to be overruling Roe. I actually believe, though I don't think the courts do this, I think a number of those justices would like to see the Constitution interpreted to say that human personhood begins at conception and that the Constitution forbids abortion. But because conservative judicial ideology criticizing Roe for so long has been leave it to the states, I think that's what they're going to do. Don't be surprised in the next 2 or 3 years.
I think Irwin is right. I think that the great unmentionable is that the next appointment will solidify a very solid Catholic conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court. It is tactless to mention that. It is an unfortunate truth that Dianne Feinstein proved herself incompetent in knowing how to raise the issue of religious beliefs and their potential interaction with the law. I think it was with Amy Barrett when she was up for confirmation then. And, you know, this is walking on eggs to suggest that religion can be relevant. But I think that to take the worst case, Trump actually wins re-election. And so the Catholic conservative majority really feels empowered. Then I think that the argument that fetuses are full-scale persons protected by the 14th Amendment will move from a fringe argument to more or less the mainstream, even if it's not necessarily a winning argument. If Trump loses, and certainly if the court is expanded, I don't see this argument going anywhere. But we just don't know what's going to happen in the next 3 or 4 years.
Erwin, what could this mean then? We've talked about voters' rights, but two specific issues, and since Sandy had raised the issue about religion, I'll start with the Obergefell case. And so LGBTQ rights, and in particular, the way in which the court had legalized gay marriage. Could we be in a scenario where the court will simply overturn that and I suppose leave it to the states, or perhaps, you know, even a different scenario?
I may be naive, but I don't think the court's going to overrule Obergefell. Now, after all, Roberts, Thomas, and Alito vehemently dissented in Obergefell. Gorsuch, in a case in 2017, made clear he thought Obergefell was wrong, and no doubt where Amy Coney Barrett or Barbara Lagoa is going to be. And yet, I don't see why they would overrule Obergefell. Gay and lesbian marriage has just become an accepted part of our society. Here's what I do predict they're going to do. I think they're going to create a broad religious basis for discriminating against gay, lesbian, and transgender individuals. I think they're going to say, if the baker, the florist, the stationery store, the videographer doesn't want to serve a same-sex wedding based on religious beliefs, they don't have to. There was a major Supreme Court decision in June protecting gays and lesbians and transgender individuals from employment discrimination in the workplace. But Justice Gorsuch's majority opinion left open the possibility of employers who have a religious objection to gay, lesbian, and transgender employees being able to discriminate. I see the conservatives creating an enormous ability of people to discriminate based on religious beliefs against gay, lesbian, and transgender individuals, but not seeing the need to overrule Obergefell.
There must be something that Erwin and I disagree about, but it hasn't emerged yet. The only thing I would say is that a goodly number of the cases that Erwin is describing are likely to be statutory rather than constitutional because they will rest on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act passed in 1993. And let me say that in 1993, which now seems like a lifetime ago, I supported RFRA, as the ACLU did and many, many liberals did. Justice Scalia's opinion in the Oregon peyote case seemed very, very harsh and seemed basically to eviscerate the notion of free exercise. But that was then and now is now. And I think that RFRA has become weaponized by the religious right. It has nothing to do with the rights of Native Americans and the like. It has everything to do, particularly with evangelical Christians and some Catholics. And, you know, but I think Erwin is otherwise completely right.
And I agree with Sandy with one exception. So we have one small area of disagreement. I too supported RFRA at the time. I thought that Justice Scalia's opinion had eviscerated the free exercise clause. Things have changed so much in 30 years for just the reason Sandy says. But I predict that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is going to become irrelevant very quickly because I think the Supreme Court's going to overturn Employment Division versus Smith. Just to be clear, Employment Division versus Smith in 1990 said there's no basis for giving religion an exception from a general law under the Constitution. So it's a case that involved Oregon prohibiting consumption of peyote. And Justice Scalia said, we don't give an exception to Native Americans based on free exercise of religion. Now I think in a case that's pending before the Supreme Court this fall, the five most conservative justices are going to overrule Employment Division versus Smith and then use free exercise of religion to protect the ability of religions to discriminate, to deny contraceptives and like, which ultimately will make RFRA unnecessary.
We're back in agreement on what very well could happen.
The other issue that keeps coming up in conversations, I'll ask this of Erwin first, is the Affordable Care Act. There's obviously a case before the court where the court could overturn the Affordable Care Act. Is this more likely? And you know, how might this play out?
I'm going to start with my rational, optimistic self. I think the challenge the Affordable Care Act before the Supreme Court this fall is frivolous. The case is California versus Texas. In 2012, the Supreme Court had before it the question of whether the individual mandate is constitutional. The individual mandate is the requirement that people either had to purchase insurance or pay a tax penalty. And the court 5-4 upheld that as constitutional. In December 2017, as part of the tax reform bill, Congress eliminated the penalty for not purchasing health insurance. Well, Texas and other states said the individual mandate was the linchpin to the Affordable Care Act, and the Congress effectively repealed the individual mandate by taking away the penalty. In a Fifth Circuit case, that therefore makes the whole Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. But therefore doesn't follow in that sentence. If a court declares unconstitutional a particular part of a statute, the question is, would Congress have adopted the rest of the statute without the part? But here, there's no doubt that Congress would have adopted the rest of the statute without this part, because it's Congress that repealed the part, unless the rest of the statute stand. In fact, in December 2017, there was a vote in Congress to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and it failed. So from a constitutional law perspective, the argument that's being advanced here seems exceedingly weak. Besides that, we're in the midst of the worst public health crisis in over a century. Does the Supreme Court really want to strike down a law that's providing 25 million people health insurance at this time? Now my more pessimistic self. Everything about the Affordable Care Act has been political since the beginning. Every Democrat in Congress voted for it. Every Republican voted against it. Before it went to the Supreme Court in 2012, with just a couple of exceptions, every Democratic judge voted to uphold it. Every Republican judge voted against it. Given how conservative, there's going to be 5 justices on the court, will they be able to get beyond that partisanship and focus on the constitutional argument in the human real-world effect if they strike down the Affordable Care Act?
Peter Finley Dunn very famously said the Supreme Court follows the election returns. If Joe Biden wins, which I think he will, it will be in substantial part because of health care. And I really have a hard time imagining that John Roberts wouldn't twist arms for the Supreme Court not to adopt what I agree with Irwin is a frivolous argument. If, on the other hand, Donald Trump wins, and we have to take account of that possibility. This is not 2016 when we were all confident that Hillary had a 90% chance of winning. Then why not strike it down? The American people would have spoken and said, we don't care about health care. We know what the Trump administration is doing, and it's fine with us. But otherwise, I think Irwin is absolutely right. And even if Trump does win, it seems to me that to invalidate Obamacare would be a poison chalice, not simply for the Supreme Court, but for the Republican Party, because they have no idea what they want to do on health policy. Just as, frankly, if Roe was overruled, I think the Republican Party will be quite rueful about this gift, because they've been running against Roe versus Wade now for literally 40 years. I think 1980 was the first time it was in the Republican platform. And Roe has been very, very good to the Republican Party, in part because they haven't been required to decide whether or not to criminalize all abortions, because after all, the fetus is a person who ought to be protected by federal law. Now, or I say now, if Roe was overturned, they're going to have to decide that. It's not going to be a pretty picture. Similarly with regard to health policy. So John Roberts is a good Republican doesn't want to overrule Roe. He wants to strangle it in the crib. And I don't think that John Roberts is a good Republican, wants to get rid of Obamacare. But his vote won't matter if, you know, the Trump appointment gets through. Then what you have to do is to make bets on the five conservatives who may be far more ideological in that sense than John Roberts is.
Erwin, last question here then. I'm reminded of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's original opposition to Roe, at least on the principle that because there had been so much movement towards abortion rights, that the court made it a legal question rather than a political question, and that it would have been on a firmer footing if the decision had been done legislatively rather than judicially.
Ginsburg's primary argument was that the court should have focused more on equal protection than due process. But for those who believe that if the court had not got involved in Roe, abortion was to become legal in the United States, Reva Siegel and Linda Greenhouse in their scholarship show quite the contrary. In 1973, only four states had legalized abortion. That there was no indication of a substantial movement towards legalized abortion then. The progress was by states adopting the so-called model penal code that allowed abortion in cases of rape and incest and when the woman's health was at stake. And also, I think that Reva Siegel and Greenhouse show, it's not that Roe created the backlash against abortion. There really wasn't any backlash until 1980 when the Republicans tried to enlist the moral majority in evangelicals to come into the Republican Party. So if not for Roe, so many millions of women would either have unwanted children or unsafe back alley abortions.
I think it's a wonderful place to end this conversation. We've discussed the legal implications, political implications of a new conservative judge replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court. Our guests have been Sanford Levinson, the W. St. John Garwood and W. St. John Garwood Jr. Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas. He's the author of numerous books, including Democracy in Dysfunction with Jack Balkin and Fault Lines in the Constitution with Cynthia Levinson, which has just come out in graphic novel form. And Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean and Jesse H. Choper, Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. He is the author of numerous books, including We the People, a progressive reading of the Constitution for the 21st century, and a recent opinion piece in the LA Times that I recommend that you look up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
When we come back, the impact of replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg by Donald Trump on public policy and law. Stay with us. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the Republican promise to replace her has profound implications for American politics and policy. How will it shape public policy, the checks and balances of the Constitution, and the 2020 election? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In 2016, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell declared he would not hold any hearings or consider then-President Obama's nominee to fill the Supreme Court seat opened by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. He would not consider Merrick Garland for the seat because of the upcoming election. But after the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, McConnell has guaranteed the president's nominee will come to the floor for a vote. It has set up a political battle that will have implications on the 2020 election, on partisanship in the Senate, and potentially the court itself. We discuss these issues with Mark Peterson, professor of public policy, political science, and law at the University of California, Los Angeles. He is working on a manuscript entitled American Sisyphus, Healthcare and the Challenge of Transformative Policymaking. And John Vile, Dean and professor of political science at Middle Tennessee State University. He is the author that has just come out of the book, The Bible in American Law and Politics. So my first question will go to Mark Peterson. You've been working on healthcare issues, and certainly this seat could have a profound impact on the Affordable Care Act. There's a case before the court that is considering the constitutionality of the act itself, the legality of the act itself, and of course, broadly, healthcare issues. How do you see this appointment having an impact on healthcare issues?
It's a terrific question, and I think it's going to be very hard for people to really try to speculate about that, and let me try to explain why. If you go to most people in the health law community, at least most of the people I know, and much the literature about how to think about the constitutionality of this law and the issue of how it has to hold together or the severance of particular provisions, it's almost nonsensical that you would think that simply by zeroing out the tax penalty for the individual mandate, which is what this is about, would suddenly make this law more compulsive rather than less compulsive, and that somehow the individual mandate, which is one part of the act and has to do with insurance coverage, and which is an important, obviously, element of the Affordable Care Act, would throw out everything in the act, particularly since Congress has made it clear, and it could have acted in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017, to go much further and to actually eviscerate the law. It didn't do that. And in the meantime, the administration has been continuing, although with a lot of hesitancy in operationalizing and applying the various elements of the law. There are 35 million people who have insurance as a result of the law, and there's nothing about those 35 million having that insurance is tied to that individual mandate, which it turned out was not particularly necessary for expanding the coverage. So it would be a stretch of an enormous degree for anyone, I think, to effectively argue, and for justices of the quality that we have on the Supreme Court to accept as an argument that this one provision in the Tax Act of 2017 eviscerates the entire Affordable Care Act.
And John Feil, what do you see as some of the core policy areas that a new court might address and could potentially, you know, have an impact on pieces of legislation or you know, generally areas of public policy that might change the previous opinions of the court?
Well, I think the conservative hope is that there's a chance that either Roe versus Wade would be overturned related to abortion, or that probably more likely that you would have more restrictions accepted at the state level. Certainly issues of federalism, conservatives tend to generally favor a little bit more state and local control over national control. Religious or conservatives often put more emphasis on the free exercise clause than they do the establishment clause. They tend to see these matters as matters of religious freedom rather than establishment of religion. And I'm sure there are, you know, a whole host of others. The one thing I always caution, you know, my students, there's been many a president who thought he knew what judges were going to do, justices were going to do, and were disappointed. And I think the one area that a lot of people are concerned about right now is, you know, what if we have a repeat this year of the 2000 election, only maybe it's even more controversial? You know, do we count, you know, write-in ballots? Do we count early voting and all of this? And I actually have a little bit more faith that even if we have a fairly conservative justice appointed, that they're going to try to call it, you know, as I'm trying to remember the analogy that I believe it was just Chief Justice Roberts used, that, you know, which is something of an exaggeration, but he hoped to be an umpire rather than a player. And I, you know, whether we have somebody for the right or the left, and I think one of the beauties of Justice Ginsburg, everybody talks about how consistent she was with women's rights and other issues, but there were also times where, you know, she voted against what you might think would be the knee-jerk liberal reaction. And, you know, certainly you've seen the same with Justice Roberts. Justice Scalia would occasionally, you know, particularly in a Fourth Amendment case or a First Amendment case, he would come out with something that wasn't that far off from what many of the liberals on the court favored.
If I could just add in there, and I think that's exactly right, I completely agree. The President Trump over the last couple of days has seemed to have interpreted the court, and in particular Gore v. Bush in 2000, as indicating that this is all about partisan politics, even at the court level. And I mean, in fairness, that case in 2000 did not shine well as breaking the notion that there's a partisan divide of the court or it's driven by partisan issues, even to the point of saying, don't take our ruling here as having any presidential value. But when the president talks in such broad partisan terms about the court and the reason why you need a ninth justice is you don't want a 4-4 split, he's just naturally assuming everybody's going to go along, not only with the issues that might arise in a very complicated election setting, but an election setting in which he himself has been probably more forceful than anyone in undermining what should be normal voting patterns and routines and acceptance of different kinds of ballots. My guess is that that the Chief Justice and the Justice Gorsuch and the Justice Kavanaugh and even Justice Barrett are not going to simply roll over in that direction, given the way that the case has been characterized thus far. So I would be frankly surprised if there's simply that kind of determination by even conservative justices, even justices appointed by Republicans, even justices appointed by President Trump himself.
May I add, and you know, U.S. versus Nixon, Rehnquist recused himself, but it was an 8-0 judgment against President Nixon, and I believe he had appointed 4 of the judges who voted against him.
Now, there is certainly a balance of power and checks and balances question, I think, when the president speaks of the impact the court could have on this election. He's even suggested the votes could end up being irrelevant because the federal, you know, the federal judges are going to decide this. I'll ask this first of Mark Peterson, because I know this is an area you've done quite a bit of work in, the relationship of the branches of government. How much will the courts themselves, the Supreme Court and just federal judges, simply say that we haven't played that role in electoral politics and we don't think we should start in 2020 from a checks and balances perspective?
I think that the leap here is just how far they could go. Obviously, in 2000, they made a determination that the vote was not going to go forward in Florida. We were talking about one state, a big state, where the differences between the two candidates and the vote count were very small. And probably the outcome was really within the noise of how you count votes and the problems in the ballots like the hanging chads. What's being posed here is a much bigger issue, including, unfortunately, apparently some conversations, including within the Trump campaign, about the prospect of trying to orchestrate having Republican legislatures at the state level decide that they're not going to allocate the Electoral College votes based on the popular votes in their states because of problems in the voting, and they're going to come to their own determination. Now, I can't imagine, frankly, particularly if more than one state does that, that the court would want to become so central to deciding that, yes, states can simply ignore whatever voting went on in the popular vote and make whatever determination the legislature wants. There's a technical constitutional avenue for that, but it would so undermine, I think, the credibility of the Supreme Court. One of the things about the court, and I'd love to hear John talk about this, one of the things about the court is it is obviously a non-democratic institution of 9 individuals. Its credibility ultimately hinges on not simply being another partisan legislature that happens to be appointed. And so ultimately, the American public will lose faith in this institution if it looks like it is simply pursuing not only a partisan, but a particular individual partisan's personal prospects. And the last thing I know that Justice Roberts wants to do is undermine that credibility. And not only that, the other thing that's hanging here is suppose that Joe Biden wins the election and suppose the Democrats take over the Senate. In particular, if the Republicans and President Trump have rammed through a court appointment at this point, it could further unleash this an ongoing cascade of trying to wrestle control over the court. And you very well may have, I don't know what the prospects are yet, but you very may well have a movement towards using what is a constitutionally available tool, which is to expand the size of the court. And then just that will keep feeding this process, and no one's willing to put their foot on the brake.
You know, another possibility, if I can add, is, you know, there have been many times in history where there's been, you know, where the court seemed to be opposing the justices, and to the political branches. One, of course, is, you know, 1937, where Roosevelt did, in fact, propose court packing. But there have been a lot of other times, some of which almost succeeded, where they've tried to trim the jurisdiction of the court. You know, we're not going to let you be the ultimate decision maker when it comes to prayer in school or desegregation or whatever. And again, most of them were not adopted, but, you know, Democrats already feel, with some justification, that, I mean, that they were cheated out of a Supreme Court justice. Now, you know, in a sense, they, you know, the president nominated, the Senate didn't confirm, you know, so the position remained vacant. But if they feel, if they also feel now that they've been sort of cheated out of another justice, you know, Trump has been extremely lucky. He's all, in part because of Mitch McConnell, but, you know, usually you get maybe one appointment every 2.5 to 3 years. He's already gotten 2 appointments, and it looks like he's going to get 3. Jimmy Carter, you may remember, in 4 years, didn't get a single appointment to the Supreme Court. So there is a chance that Republicans will rue the day that they push not one but 2 justices through, and maybe did, and if you sow to the wind, you may reap the whirlwind. I sort of hope we don't. I tend to be more concerned about the institutions than I am about who's there at the moment. But you do get to this breaking point where people say enough is enough. If we, you know, if the politics isn't going to work, then we're gonna try constitutional means, or extra constitutional means, perhaps.
And there is this, if I may, Doug, what I would view as a kind of a ratcheting up process that leaves. And I don't think it's each side is quite the same, although each side certainly has played a political role in how it's been handling these issues. But if we go back to, for instance, the filibuster wasn't used very often. And then it started to get used quite significantly when Republicans were in the minority starting in the 90s. And then once that got ratcheted up, the Democrats kind of said, okay, if you're going to do that, we're going to do that. And then the next time the Republicans were in the minority, they ratcheted it up again. And by the time you get to the first years of the Obama administration, the filibuster is now a routine instrument of opposition. And anything of significance, almost anything of significance, has to have a 60 vote majority to get through. Complete change in the norm of how the filibuster had been used in the past. Then you get to Obama and the judicial nominations, and Mitch McConnell, who is a master craftsman of using every instrument, used the filibuster to try to keep the president from making all kinds of judicial appointments, district level, court of appeals level, and then ultimately with the Supreme Court with Merrick Garland. And so part of what happened in that environment is that Harry Reid, for better or for worse, decided he had to blow up the nuclear option, the use of the filibuster for judicial nominations below the Supreme Court. Otherwise, they weren't going to be able to move, because the standard that Republicans were applying to the president's nominations was one that really was going to basically keep seats empty. And that's what Mitch McConnell accomplished, ultimately, even with Harry Reid finally breaking down. And then, of course, the Republicans come back to the majority, and the President Obama is a Democrat, and now they up the notch again to getting rid of the filibuster, even at the Supreme Court level. I put a little more weight of responsibility on the Republican side than I would on the Democratic side, but it certainly has created this avenue towards who knows what's going to happen in the next term of Congress and presidency if the Democrats do take over.
Doug, if you'd let me come in here as well. Yes. I don't know why, because it's, you know, the first case that many people have in their constitutional law class is Marbury versus Madison. And while we're talking about, you know, how we're as polarized as we've ever been in our history, there may be some real parallels to 1800. If you'll remember, you know, Marbury comes to the court on the basis that he's had a commission that has been signed and sealed but never delivered. And who's, you know, who's running the court? Well, the last appointment of John Adams, pretty much as he left the White House, you know, Chief Justice John Marshall. And that, you know, that conflict, which, you know, initially, well, you know, the well, Republicans won the election, but before they got there, Federalists had stacked the courts. Well, the Republicans went back and pulled some of those circuit court positions. And there was, you know, it really instituted a great deal of turmoil for the next, you know, 10 or 20 years. And I, in some ways, I think we are, at, you know, at a similar axis point in American history.
So you're painting a picture here of this extreme and deep partisanship. And of course, one of the examples you used, that you both have used, is the filibuster and the use of that, you know, as a practice to kind of slow up and make, you know, passing legislation more difficult. There's an expectation that if the Democrats do in fact win the Senate in 2020, they may very well do away with the filibuster and could create a scenario where the two parties really have removed brakes on majorities. Once they win an election, can pass whatever they would like. Now, of course, the court might be one of those breaks and might overturn some of that. But how much, and I'll, Mark Peterson, I'll ask you first, how much has this partisanship, it may very well have opened up the possibility for more legislation to be passed. And is this necessarily a good thing, or are we going to rue the day that we've done away with some of these different breaks, which basically meant Congress was a lot less effective, with the breaks, and simply more effective at passing policies?
I think it's a really complicated question, and here's why. First of all, one of the reasons why the filibuster existed for such a long time and has continued to exist for regular legislation right now is that neither party has wanted to look to the future and see themselves in the minority without any possibility of stopping legislation or creating a requirement for some kind of compromise. That worked in a world in which the parties were not so deeply divided. And frankly, if you look at the ideological data, one of the things that's happened is that while the Democrats have kind of moved to the left over the last 30 years, kind of back to more of a standard place for them, the Republican Party is really in the Congress has moved dramatically to the right. So it's a very different Republican Party in Congress today. And so you add that you have a very conservative Republican Party in Congress, more conservative than it had been in any time, frankly, since the start of this party system in 1860. And then you throw in the fact of the way the Senate is elected, which is obviously by state. And you look at the popular vote, or the votes cast for Democrats and Republicans for the Senate in the last three elections, and you see that the Democrats have actually won overwhelmingly the Senate votes at the individual voter level, but because of the way the Senate is set up, the Republicans have come away with a 53-seat majority. That just adds further tension now to what that filibuster is doing, and in a way, not only creating a forced discussion, but leveraging the role of a minority segment of the population to be able to wrest control over government, and particularly to do that with a president now who has lost the popular vote in 2016, and a court now that has for quite some time been dominated by Republican appointees. So that's the context in which there's such a sense of having to now and get rid of the filibuster. Now, the other side of the equation is, yes, it could mean that Democrats, if Joe Biden wins and if the Democrats take the Senate, would have an opportunity for moving legislation and maybe even moving some significant pieces of legislation. But frankly, they're going to be doing that under this environment or in this environment in purely in a purely partisan vote in which they're going to be few, if any, Republicans supporting that legislation. And some of these are pretty big themes that you'd like to have where the public may be behind them, but you'd like to have the institutions of government more coherent and cohesive in moving them forward, knowing in the next election, tide could turn and they could completely reverse again. Look what's happened with the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act, some of the central features of that law came out of the Heritage Foundation and Republican ranks going back to early 1990s. And now the very provisions that were being pushed by conservatives and Republicans to try to have a different way of getting the healthcare reform are now considered socialism and anathema and challenged by Republicans as Ben Carson said when he was running for president, it's the worst thing since slavery. I mean, it's the turnaround on these things is just astonishing. But it does mean that we're not going to see anytime soon an opportunity for real coming together unless one of the parties finally feels like it's really on the verge of being simply kept out of the American political process because of where the public stands on these issues.
Doug, may I add, one of the things that I find fascinating, and Mark probably is a better expert on this than I am, but what seems to be the increasing use of executive orders, we're almost, you know, one of the criticisms of parliamentary systems, you know, why the separation of powers was supposed to be better was that we weren't supposed to lurch, you know, from one election to the other. But you can be pretty sure if Biden is elected, you know, just as you were when Trump is elected, that the first day you're not going to be going to Congress, you're going to start issuing executive orders. And, you know, so much of the Trump administration has been, if Obama was for it, we're going to cancel it. And I suspect that you get a good bit of that if Biden is elected.
I think you will. I think you'll see a lot of reversals of executive orders. One of the interesting things is when you look at the data of executive orders, Obama was not at all out of the norm. In fact, he was right at the norm for modern presidents. And the person who's used more executive orders than anyone in the modern era is Donald Trump, who had, of course, decried the excessive executive authority and power of Obama's trying to seize in various ways. But now that that has been set up, those executive orders, one of the things about them is they can be easily reversed the moment you walk in the door, which is why you don't want to rest the whole policy on them. Of course, now the other thing is President Trump, and this is a nuance that I don't think most people have really understood or appreciated. In the Supreme Court's decision on DACA, which did not allow President Trump's administration to immediately terminate DACA, John Yoo, law professor at Berkeley, has interpreted the range of action that the court granted the executive order from Obama such scope that you could just test the limits as far as you want to go. Now, President Trump got that whispered into his ear because he's not a constitutional scholar and because he actually is not much of an institutionalist or has that much knowledge about American history, has taken that to mean he can do anything he wants until he's told he can't. And so now he's going to reform the U.S. healthcare system and the immigration system, the education system, everything through executive orders. And if, in fact, he loses and in fact, we get a transition back to the Democrats with Joe Biden, you're going to see a lot of things have to switch pretty dramatically. It's running government in a way that is so beyond the norm of what the average American citizen has any reason to pay attention to, and it just then creates this sense of chaos, which is hard for people to then get behind the political system.
And that's compounded, if I may, by, you know, can we take money from one project appropriated for, you know, you used to be able to say, you know, the Congress passes a law, the president enforces it, and the judiciary interprets it. I don't know what to say anymore, other than it's a mess.
Now, John Vowell, sort of last question I want to make sure to ask you this. You've just published a book on the Bible and American law and politics, yes, and the courts. Almost assuredly, if any of the leading candidates are actually the choice of the president to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it's more than likely going to be a Roman Catholic. What does this mean for the court to have that large of a voice, a Roman Catholic voice on the court?
It would have made a really big difference 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in recent years, you've had your, you know, particularly your more conservative Catholics line up with your evangelical Christians on a whole host of issues, particularly religious freedom, abortion, these kind of things. And so, you know, I particularly the justice, judge rather in Indiana, Amy Barrett, as far as I can tell, evangelical Christians would be delighted to have her on there. But gone are the days, you know, when I was an undergraduate, certainly in graduate school, we talk about having a Jewish seat on the court. And for many years, you know, starting with Chief Justice Taney, there was a Roman Catholic seat. And now we do have, you know, Roman Catholic majority and some Jews. We need a Baptist, Methodist, Pentecostal, I'm not sure what. But, you know, I don't think there should be a religious test for being on the Supreme Court. You know, we certainly don't want to exclude somebody because they're Jewish. If you're not going to do that, you shouldn't exclude them because they're Catholic or, you know, whatever. I'm very uncomfortable with, you know, in the case of Barrett saying, well, she's a member of this congregation and that congregation believes that, so she must. I just don't really think that has much place in American politics.
Well, with that, we have been discussing the politics ranging from the checks and balances concerns about the role the court has been playing in policymaking, the impact of partisanship, and the possibility of some fairly significant changes in Congress as a result of these political developments, and certainly the impact on the 2020 election, not just at the presidential level, but the importance of certainly both houses of Congress and the role that that's going to play in politics post-election. I want to thank our guests. Our guests for this segment have been Mark Peterson, professor of public policy, political science, and law at the University of California, Los Angeles. He is working on a manuscript entitled American Sisyphus, Healthcare, and the Challenge of Transformative Policymaking. And John Vile, Dean and Professor of Political Science at Middle Tennessee State University. He is the author of the very, very recently released The Bible in American Law and Politics. Thank you both.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Thanks.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.